Support for Jim Pease's Talk of Iowa Wildlife Call-In Program comes from the Iowa Natural Heritage Foundation. Details on how you can protect wildlife habitat are at inhf.org. From Iowa Public Radio, it's Talk of Iowa. I'm Dennis Reese. Like we're used to in Iowa, it seemed to turn very quickly from winter to full-fledged spring this year. And right after the warm weather started, we heard... Yes, it's the small but mighty western chorus frog. And the Iowa frogs seem to be really noisy this year. Maybe they think it's summer. It's Wildlife Day on Talk of Iowa with Jim Pease. Joining Jim this hour is Rebecca Christoffel, Extension Wildlife Specialist. We'll find out how Iowa's frogs and toads are faring, from the gray tree frog to the spring peeper to the northern leopard frog. I guess I should mention a toad. How about Woodhouse's toad? She's a great insect eater. Talk of Iowa Wildlife Day, after news from Iowa Public Radio and NPR. This is Talk of Iowa for today. I'm Dennis Reese. It's Wildlife Day on the program with Jim Pease, Professor Emeritus, and Rebecca Christoffel, Iowa State University Extension Wildlife Specialist. Good morning, you guys.
Good morning.
Good morning, Dennis.
Now, I want to quote from Iowa State's Your Own Extension booklet.
Okay.
It's available on the web. Early in the spring, even before the last snow has disappeared, one of the first signs of spring is the call of the western chorus frog. Well, it may be only an inch long, it makes a big noise. Now, is this what I'm hearing outside my bedroom window?
Quite likely. You know, this is the time of year, Dennis, that reminds me once again that I am so glad that I'm a citizen of the northern temperate regions because there's so much change going on every single day. Every day has something new. I mean, the wildflowers are blooming like crazy. The frogs are coming out. You have different species that are coming out practically on a daily basis. You have new birds arriving. I saw a ruby-crowned kinglet just yesterday. So it's just been amazing. You know, the bloodroots have bloomed. The hepaticas are bloomed. A lot of people have been asking me about the spring ephemerals that are out there, those short-lived spring flowers in our deciduous woodlands that are just so incredibly beautiful at this time of year. But boy, that sense of change is such a renewing sort of sense of hope, I think, for all of us. I was in Costa Rica with students 2 or 3 weeks ago now, and while I love Costa Rica, I've taken lots and lots of students there, love the climate. The climate is the same the year round, and I think. Mm-hmm. I would really miss this change of the seasons that we're having, like in spring, and the chorus frogs are one of those things that that I would sincerely miss very, very much.
When the weather changes so quickly, Jim, I mean, it just turns so fast.
Yeah.
Is it like a time machine where the animals think it's summer and they really have to move really quickly with their mating and whatever else they're up to now?
No, it's not a matter of thinking it's summer. They respond to the conditions, and that includes both the photo period, the day length, and the temperatures of the soils and the waters around them. The critters that hibernated through the winter, the ground squirrels and the woodchucks, are below the soil, and as that soil temperature changes, that triggers the mechanism for them to gradually come out. Same with the spring wildflowers. As soon as the soil temperatures are just above 40, they just barely reach 45 degrees, and the hepaticas are springing out of the ground. You know, spring beauties are at about 48 degrees. So you know, it's different triggers for mm-hmm. different critters, and the presence of those. Of their water in these what are called sort of temporary wetlands, vernal pools in our woodlands and along some of our wetlands. A lot of these wetlands are going to just be around for a very, very short period of time yeah. with the spring rains. And the frogs have to take advantage of them right now in order to have enough time to develop. I tell you, to tell us some more about frogs, I thought we'd bring an expert in today who really knows her herps. That's the generic term mm-hmm. for reptiles and amphibians is, as you mentioned, The beginning of the show, Rebecca Christoffel, Dr. Rebecca Christoffel, is the new Extension Wildlife Specialist here at Iowa State, and want to welcome her to Iowa. She's been in the state now for a few months and gotten around the state since the fall, gotten to know lots of folks. Welcome, Rebecca.
Yeah, welcome, Rebecca. So how do you like Iowa so far?
Oh, I love it.
Good.
Yeah, I couldn't ask for better. I've been making a round of the upper Midwestern states, starting in Illinois, going to Wisconsin, and being in Wisconsin for more than about 15 years, going to Michigan for a few years, then going to Indiana for a year. And, of course, I've worked in Minnesota for about the last 10 years, and Iowa was the last horizon. So I'm finally here and hopefully here to stay.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. I'm glad you like it so far. We took a little trip down to Muscatine last weekend. This is a frog question, by the way. And Jim was talking about wetlands, and there's just so many wetlands near the Mississippi and Cedar Rivers in that area. But these frogs were so noisy. Now, this group of frogs sounded, I'm trying to describe it, like tiny little gunshots or like a percussive instrument of some kind. What is that all about? Do you know what I'm talking about?
Well, try.
Yes. You got it. There we go. That is, you win, Jim. You win the prize.
That was Rebecca.
Rebecca.
Surprise.
Well, surprise.
Chorus frog. That's your powerful little chorus frog doing his thing.
That is the chorus frog.
Yeah. Yeah, I noticed.
Why don't you ever see him?
Oh, they're tiny. They're only about an inch long at the longest, or an inch and a half. And as soon as you start approaching them, notice how loud the chorus frog is. Mm. And as you get closer and closer, all of a sudden, silence.
Yeah.
And you can't find it. That's right, really good defense it has.
Okay.
Blends in beautiful. It is the quintessential prairie frog. You find these in grassland areas, along the sides of roads and the ditches. They're just fabulous. I could hear them on I-35 when I was headed down to Des Moines about a week ago, and I was amazed with all of the traffic noise that I could still hear the frogs.
Yeah, they're really loud. So what are they up to?
Well, those males are the ones who are calling. In case you weren't aware, it's the males who call, not the females. And they're basically advertising, hey, baby, I'm here. Come on over. And so it's breeding time, which is just a fabulous, fabulous time of year. And they were certainly the first frog that I heard calling here this year.
Really? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Frogs don't drink water but absorb it through their skin. Is that right?
Yep, they have oftentimes what we call a brood patch almost on their belly where they can uptake water. So they don't actually have to drink water. They have permeable skins, which are great in terms of getting water, provided it's good quality water. It's not so great when there are pollutants in the water. And so we often find that amphibians are fabulous indicators of habitat quality. Even not in the water, when they're on dry land, again, they are absorbing things from their surroundings. They crawl on the ground, you know, oftentimes, and so they're fabulous indicators of whether or not this is a good property to be living on.
Okay. We want to get our IPR listeners involved here in this conversation. Frogs and Toads Today, Wildlife Day, with Jim Pease, Professor Emeritus, and Rebecca Christoffel. I am saying that right, am I not, Rebecca?
Yes, it's Rebecca Christoffel.
Okay, thank you. Iowa State University Extension Wildlife Specialist. She likes it in Iowa so far, likes our frogs. 866-780-9100 is the toll-free number to call to take part in our program today. 866-780-9100. And the email is talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. So how is the Iowa frog population faring? We're hearing about frogs dying off in much of the world, and many scientists are not even sure why this is happening. But how are things in Iowa for the frog population?
Well, it certainly appears that our chorus frogs are doing fine. the way that we actually keep track of frog populations in Iowa is through the use of breeding frog surveys. So we listen for them. And there are many people, the Iowa DNR actually has a volunteer program where you can be trained and you can help to actually monitor frog populations here. And what people do is they go out three times a year. Once, generally in April, when water temperature is about 50 degrees Fahrenheit. Once in May, when water temperature is about 60 degrees Fahrenheit. And then a last time around mid-June to early July, when water temperature is up about 70 degrees Fahrenheit. And the reason is that we have what we call guilds of frogs. So we have different little subsets of our frogs and toads who call during each of these three periods, depending on water temperature. And so this is a way to find out, do we have a lot of frogs or only a few frogs in an area? What you should be aware of is that though we have one of the oldest frog and toad volunteer breeding surveys, we've still only been keeping track of these animals for about 15 years or so. And so how plentiful were they 50 years ago? You have to go back into the historic literature and look, but it's all anecdotal. What I should mention is that 2010 is the first year that Iowa is participating in something called the North American Amphibian Monitoring Program, and it's a scientifically set up program across the U.S. Where people are going out and listening for these animals so we get a better handle on where the populations are today and can actually answer some of those questions in terms of our populations increasing or decreasing and where is it that they are increasing or decreasing.
So for people who want to take part in this project, where do they go?
Well, they should go to the Iowa Department of Natural Resources website to the non-game program. Stephanie Shepherd is the person who's in charge of the program, and I will also be providing that information so we can post it up on the web after the program.
Okay. Let's go to one call before we take a break. This is Tom calling from Indianola. Hello, Tom. You're on Talk of Iowa.
Hi there. I've got a question that's kind of off the subject here, but I'd like to know, the geese go on nest and it looks to me like they like a chicken. They lay an egg or two a day, and then sometime later it seems like all the little goslings hatch on the first day. Is that just my perception, or is this right?
No, that's correct. What they do is they'll lay an egg or so, about an egg a day. Sometimes they might skip a day, depends on the health of the geese, but of the goose rather. And they will once they get kind of like with laying hens, they get to a certain point at which they kind of get enough that they can kind of cover it with their body, and then they go broody, what's called broody, and they will stop laying eggs and sit on the eggs that they have, and they will stay for long periods of time. If you ever watched a hen on eggs, a laying hen on eggs, it's almost like they're in this state of suspended animation. You know, they're not; they're awake, but they just kind of sit there. I don't know what he's got going on in the background there.
These are frogs.
Spring peepers.
Spring peepers.
Right,
Tom,
right.
Thanks. Tom, thanks. We have to take a break. We'll go out with some spring peepers.
Okay.
Be back in a minute as Talk of Iowa continues on Iowa Public Radio. Talk of Iowa continues on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Dennis Reese. It's Wildlife Day with Jim Pease and with Jim in the studio, and our Ames studio at Iowa Public Radio is Rebecca Christoffel, Iowa State University Extension Wildlife Specialist. Let's see. I don't know if we were quite finished.
Yeah, I wasn't.
Yes, he has left, so you took care of.
Well, I was just going to answer the second part of his question.
Okay,
and that
go ahead.
Is about whether they all hatch at once, and indeed they do. And like most ground nesting birds, particularly geese and ducks, they're all precocial. That means that within a few hours after hatching, they're up and running around and actually can swim very, very soon after birth, so after they come out. So his perceptions are correct.
Okay. Just one quick question before we go back to calls. Why is it that I have never actually seen an Iowa frog? I hear them all the time. But I've seen a toad. We have a toad visitor and a planter every year, just one guy or mm-hmm. gal. He or she settles in this planter, cute as he can possibly be.
Uh-huh.
But it's a toad. I don't know what kind of toad. Would you have an idea?
Probably American toad. That's
American
the one that
toad,
is most yeah. common. And, you know, it's interesting. I one of the great things you do when you're work is for extension is you get lots of things in the mail, Dennis. And one day I got a card that had a flattened toad about the size of my thumb taped to the card. And it said,
no.
This is for real. It says, what are these things? They show up by the thousands all at one day, and all of a sudden they're gone. It was just great. You know, they'd stepped on one accidentally, and it dried out, and so they taped it to a card and sent it to me. And what happens is that just as these are synchronous in their mating, so that they're all singing at once, and so they sound very, very loud, they are also synchronous in their hatching. And so most of them will all hatch on the same day or within 24 hours or so of the same day that are in the same bunch of water anyway, because they develop based on the temperature of the water. And so they will all hatch at once, and they do, in fact, will invade. You only have a single individual,
mm-hmm. yeah.
Probably the same one for several years at least, mm-hmm. keeps coming back.
Yeah.
But sometimes people have lots of them. They're about the size of your fingernail when they first start out, and after that they will grow up to be much larger. But you probably have American toad, and that's quite common. Come back to the same place every year.
And he's what, sleeping in there during the day, and probably goes out at night? Is that what he's doing?
Well, he has to maintain that that moist skin, so he's probably either in the soil or under leaves or under the mulch or something like that during the day, and comes out when the temperatures are appropriate for him.
Okay. Let's go to Karen, who's calling from Griswold. Karen, good morning.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I have a couple of short questions about frogs and toads. The first one is about eastern chorus frogs. I hear them very close to my house in the farmer's fields, and they've already started. They start very early. And I would swear that there's absolutely no moisture out there where they're chorusing. But should I presume that there has to be water if they're out there calling to each other?
There certainly is moisture out there for them. It may not be visible to us. It may be just little. Even sometimes it's as little as a tire rut can provide enough water for these animals to get them excited. Again, the hormones are going like crazy, so the guys are just looking for any kind of water body. And in terms of our early spring breeders, things like chorus frogs and spring peepers, they really want to be in fishless waters. They want to be in those waters that are only temporary. And so it's a race against time in terms of the development of the youngsters once the eggs hatch out, before the water body dries up.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Karen.
I have one more question about tiny frogs.
Yes, go ahead.
I visit a playground that's in a wooded area. It's kind of moist and it has long grass. And there are many, many different kinds of tiny frogs there, many different colors. They're less than an inch long. And I'm wondering if there are several or maybe even many species of these tiny frogs.
Well, there aren't many species of these tiny frogs, though I should say one thing about amphibians and reptiles generally, and that is that they're highly variable in terms of color and patterning. And so it could all be that those are chorus frogs that you're seeing. If there's a wooded area nearby, there may be spring peepers. They, too, are tiny little frogs, but they really are tied to having woodlands nearby. And so it depends on exactly where you're at. You may have both of those. You can tell if they're calling. The chorus frog, again, is this one. The spring peeper will be more like this. So it's kind of easy to tell the difference between their songs.
Okay. Are you doing that yourself, Rebecca?
I have my props with me.
Oh, you have your props with you.
Sure, but if you'd like to do American Toad. That one's all me.
I was going to go out with that before they have it all queued up.
Thank you.
I may still go out with it anyway because that's my one and only amphibian.
Sure.
On the property. Thanks, Karen. 866-780-9100. We have lines open. 866-780-9100. Talk of Iowa at iowapublicradio.org. Bridget is next from Des Moines. Good morning, Bridget.
Hi there.
Hi.
I just had a couple quick questions, actually. Recently, I was in a pet store over on the west side of Des Moines, and they had a leopard frog in with, like, their goldfish and water plants. I was just wondering, I'd heard a while ago that leopard frogs were scarce and close to, and like, being endangered and stuff. I just didn't know if that was true and why a pet store would have a leopard frog.
Well, there are a couple of things that are going on. For one, oftentimes when they get their things like their goldfish and that, it's sort of as a bycatch product. There are frogs or tadpoles that are also netted in getting the fish. And so what you end up with is having this tadpole or frog actually traveling with the goldfish and ending up either at a pet store or at a bait store. I used to live down the street from a bait store when I lived in Wisconsin, and I was constantly getting calls from the woman who owned the bait store to come on by and pick up, you know, these frog bycatch that she had, and she was getting her minnows from Louisiana, and so there were some things there that really shouldn't be let loose in Wisconsin, so
yeah.
I kept them for her. So that's one thing. But you ask about leopard frogs, and that's a great question. For one, leopard frogs, back in 1995 in Minnesota, there were some kids on a field trip, and they discovered a pond with leopard frogs. And lo and behold, a lot of these leopard frogs were what we call malformed. They had extra sets of legs and that. Yeah. And in the past, leopard frogs were collected heavily for biological supply houses. In Wisconsin, there was a time period when there was a horrible outbreak of red leg disease in leopard frogs. But again, they're not being collected, at least in, here, for biological supply houses, and the populations seem to have rebounded quite a bit. Of course, all of our amphibians, remember, they're great indicators of habitat quality. And so if there are a lot of things in the water that don't belong there, it's not going to be so great for these animals. Mm-hmm. In the case of leopard frogs, what they do is they overwinter in very deep water, in lakes or streams, and they lay dormant on the bottom of the lake or stream. In the spring, they emerge from the water body, and they travel to a smaller water body in order to breed, all right? And so the leopard frog, when he's calling, sounds a bit like somebody snoring. You know, it's not very musical at all, but somehow it attracts the females. And when they're through breeding, the adults will move up to a mile from any standing water in these grassland areas and be feeding on insects and such until the fall when they move their way back to these large water bodies. So there's an animal that needs three specific habitat types in order to complete its life cycle, all within the course of about 6 months' time. So that puts it at a disadvantage as compared to some other animals who only need one or even two habitat types.
Bridget, we're out of time for the break. We have to take a break. Thanks so much for the call. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you so much.
Snoring attracts the females. So that is very...
I haven't found it to be the case.
Yeah, something you could tell your wife sometime.
Oh, my gosh. Well, we're going to go out with this. And you guys know what it is?
American Toad, by
that
chance?
That is absolutely correct. That's my American Toad. Okay. We'll take a break on Talk of Iowa. Be back in 5 minutes as Talk of Iowa continues after the Environment Report. Welcome back to Talk of Iowa. I'm Dennis Reese. Wildlife Day on the program, always a great hour, with Dr. Jim Pease, Professor Emeritus at Iowa State, and Rebecca Christoffel, Iowa State University Extension Wildlife Specialist. reading some frog facts. Largest frog. How about it? Do you guys know?
Goliath frog in Africa.
Rebecca, you are really on top of things here.
You don't want to run into that one. That one's really large, about 2 feet long or so.
I just, you know, I would just drop over if I saw a frog that big.
You and me both.
Okay.
How about the smallest frog? Do you know the smallest frog?
I do, because it says it's from Cuba.
That's right, right. Tiny, tiny, tiny little guy.
And there's only 88 species of frogs in the United States and Canada, 4,000 worldwide. So we don't have all that many here.
No, we don't. We're too cold.
Yeah.
You really have to go to the tropics if you want to see a tremendous diversity of frogs and toads. However, you should know that the U.S. is the hot spot for salamander diversity, which is another group of amphibians. And the Appalachian Mountains, for as old as that mountain range is, really was fabulous for speciation of salamanders. So we may not have as many frogs and toads, but, hey, we're where it's at for salamanders.
Okay. It's
also, though, the fact that in the tropics, a lot of those frog species are disappearing. It was one of the things that I think first alerted scientists to the problems with climate change is that it occurs in the extremes of the Earth, certainly in the poles, but also along the equator. And there's never any question to people that I work with in Central America that global warming is happening, because they see it every day. they're out, and boy, we've got frog species disappearing on a yearly basis, probably even more frequently than that in Central and South America. So,
yeah, I should point out, I've been starting to give some programs to people on amphibians, and people are always amazed to learn that, you know, just since 1980, worldwide, we've lost more than 120 species of amphibians worldwide. So, you know, if you talked about losing mammals at that sort of rate, people would just be beside themselves in, you know, doing things. But the amphibians don't seem to have garnered quite the attention, though there is a heck of a lot more attention to them now. And, of course, the latest blow that they've had is this fungal disease spreading across the continent, and the American Zoo and Aquarium Association has been taking whole populations of these animals in to captivity until they can once again safely put them out in their native habitat once this fungal disease has passed through and done its thing.
Okay. We have an email from, I believe it's Time in Ames, and he or she says, I have a 15-year-old son who loves all wildlife and spends a great deal of time in the creek and creek banks studying frogs, fish, clams, insects, etc. I want to encourage his interest in nature, and I'm looking for any suggestions for summer volunteer activities, especially in and around the Ames area.
Well, there are lots of things that are available, especially in Iowa, through our County Conservation Board programs. So I would encourage her to first point of contact would be the naturalist at the County Conservation Board, and that would be Story County in the Ames area. And there are several naturalists there, talking with Jerry Keyes or any of the other naturalists of his staff out there would be a really good place to start. There are certainly also programs, as Rebecca mentioned, available through the Iowa DNR that are citizen science sorts of things, particularly the frog and toad monitoring. There may be someone doing nature mapping programs here in central Iowa. They can get involved that way as well, and he could monitor the things in his own backyard, which would be really fabulous. And Rebecca knows about that because she's heading up that program now, and so if he could contact Rebecca directly as well.
Okay, Rebecca, do you want to mention your email?
Yes, my email is christ@iastate.edu.
Okay. Let's go to Jim, who's calling from Spirit Lake. Question about turtles. Good morning, Jim.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. When I was growing up in the late 50s and 60s in northwest Iowa, it seemed like there were turtles virtually everywhere, any pond or creek, and now I don't seem to see them anymore. What's causing that? And I'll hang up and listen to your response.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Rebecca wants to handle that, right?
Well, I can make some guesses, but I don't know specifically what's been going on there. So I'll ask you, Jim.
Well, I think what happens is certainly we've got lots of changes going on in the landscape. I don't know how old the gentleman Jim was called from Spirit Lake, but certainly the changes in the landscape since I was growing up in southeastern Iowa in the 1950s and 60s. Have been substantial. You know, the farming has changed. Towns and cities have expanded, and there are lots more roads. Rebecca mentioned the need for different kinds of habitats, and that's certainly true in turtles as well as it is in amphibians. And when you have the kind of massive changes that we've had in the last half century in Iowa to, you know, major portions of our landscape, we've gone from small farms with multiple kinds of livestock, and had some row crops certainly, and but it was a real mixed farming, to really pretty structured large farms, row crop agriculture, removal of fence rows, get rid of the all those things that were in the way. Very little habitat, very little connection then between the habitat that is left, what we call fragmentation, and that kind of massive landscape change changes a lot of critters. And some of the ones that are affected immediately are those that have special habitat needs, which may be the reptiles or the amphibians in particular, and things like spiders and other things as well. But it depends on the kind of turtle he was seeing. You know, certainly painted turtles are more adaptable than some of our other species, wood turtles, for example. I would suspect that generally the change in the landscape has been so massive that it's really impacted them.
One thing that I'd like to add is that probably another factor has to do, again, with those roads. If you think back to the late 50s and 60s, you know, what was the speed limit on roads? How fast did cars go? What was the volume of traffic on roads? Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, things like snapping turtles will travel more than a mile to find a suitable nesting site. Now, think about it. You know, where can you go more than a mile on the landscape and not run into a road? And unfortunately, a lot of times when they're up on roads, is near dusk, they're dark-bodied, the road is dark. It's kind of hard if you're going 70 miles an hour to stop in time, particularly if you've got somebody in the lane next to you. So that has been a real troublemaker for turtle populations. The ones most likely to get killed on the roads are big females filled with eggs. Mm. And so you don't just kill that female, you basically kill all of that potential recruitment to the population.
Okay. 866-780-9100. Let's go to Blue in Ames. Good morning.
Good morning. I'd like to extend a wide, wonderful welcome from Iowa to Dr. Christopher at Iowa State. And hello, Dr. Pease.
Hi, how are you?
My question is on Iowa snakes waking up now, including water snakes, and also if you would speak to the, as you did, to the human encroachment. I would like to know what signs young persons out in nature can look for in central Iowa and southeastern Iowa, particularly for snakes waking up, if we have any.
Sure.
And a second part of my question is if it's acceptable to own non-poisonous snakes as pets.
Okay, well,
what would be your choice for a pet snake?
All right, well,
for kiddos older than Tots.
Okay. Well, first, let's talk about Iowa snakes waking up. And thank you for that welcome, and thank you for bringing this up. That's a perfect segue. I said to Jim, I really wanted to bring up garter snakes. I have been fielding garter snake calls like you wouldn't believe for the last 2 weeks because they are emerging from hibernation. And I've had a number of people calling. They've got a quote-unquote nest of snakes in the yard, and they're afraid the snakes are trying to get into their house. And then I have the enviable task of telling them that probably those snakes are leaving your house versus trying to go in. They probably overwintered in your basement. If there are any sorts of cracks in a foundation, a basement is a wonderful place to overwinter. Unlike many of our frogs, our snakes cannot deal with freezing temperatures. They must avoid the frost line in order to survive the winter. And so these nests of snakes that people are seeing in their yards are generally garter snakes that have emerged. And the garter snakes are pretty slow when they first emerge because they've been really, really cold. But garter snakes are kind of neat. They do their breeding while still at the place where they hibernated over winter. So you'll see one really rather large snake, and many people mistake that for the mom. And then there are a bunch of little smaller snakes, about 18 to 24 inches long, and they're all hanging around this larger snake. And so people think that's a mom with her brood of youngsters. What it really is a female with a brood of males trying to breed with her. It's a mating ball of garter snakes. And these 18 to 24 inch long males are all trying to gain access to the female. And, you know, they're pretty clever. Once that male finally is able to breed with the female, he'll leave sort of a mucus plug in her so that nobody else can inseminate her. For a few days, at least.
So nice to be wanted. You know,
yes. Yeah, talk about being wanted. So I get to tell people that this is very temporary and that you're very lucky to actually observe this. And within the next couple of weeks, as breeding activity slows down and as these animals warm up, they are going to disperse onto the landscape where they will more or less live solitarily. And remember those wonderful things that we're listening to calling at night? Well, that's a great meal for a garter snake. They do a lot of eating of our frogs, but that's okay.
Now, can you, you know, I have tons of them. Can you pick them up? Is that okay just to pick them up? Or, you know?
Well, to pick up frogs, generally what I say to people is make sure you have wet hands and you have no bug dope on them or anything. Okay. You're not going to get hurt. What I most get concerned about is the person hurting the animal. Again, they are have skin that's highly permeable and it's got a little bit of a mucus coating on it usually. Mm-hmm. And you don't want to wipe that mucus coating off. You don't want to damage that in any way.
But I was wondering about garter snakes. Can you pick up a garter snake?
Oh, sure. You can pick up a garter snake. Okay. In fact, I'd love to see you pick one up because it'll immediately sort of exude the stinky musk from its cloaca so that both you and the snake smell sort of like a fox, kind of musky.
Oh,
and garter snakes are famous for biting. Yeah. Again, you represent a big predator in terms of the snake. They have lots of little needle-sharp teeth that they'll use. They don't chew their food at all. And what they'll do is they'll leave a perfect little outline of their mouth on your arm or wherever it is that they bite you.
But they're harmless. The bite is harmless. They're not poisonous at all. So, but like any other bite, you just treat it with a little disinfectant and they'll be fine. But,
yeah.
I'm glad I asked you, but now I know. Very good. Let's go to Tom.
Can we answer the second part of the question about a pet?
Tom, hold on a second. Hold on a second. She's got one more answer here, okay?
Yeah, it's for the pet snake. And what I say is you really want to get a captive bred snake. Don't take something out from the wild, particularly because once you have it in captivity, you're not going to want to release it into the wild. You might introduce some sort of disease organism into that wild population. There are many reputable breeders out there. A fabulous snake for a child is what we call a corn snake. They breed them in many different color varieties, and they have lots of good manuals on how to care for these animals. And so if you're going to go that route, that is what I would say.
Okay, let's go to Tom. I hope he's still Tom. Tom, are you there? You're on the air.
Tom in Des Moines?
Yes, go ahead.
Yeah, hi. I had a question about tree frogs. When I was a kid and detasseled in the cornfields, occasionally we'd come across one in the kind of cup of the corn. And then sometimes years ago, I used to hear what I thought were tree frogs in the trees in Ames when I lived in Ames. Mm-hmm. And I was just wondering how big a population, you never see them, or very rarely. I was wondering how big a population of tree frogs we have in Iowa.
Well, again, tree frogs are really a woodland frog, more or less. They want to have trees. And so where we have good populations of wooded areas, particularly along riparian areas, you should still be able to hear tree frogs. Seeing them is another question. These are animals generally that we're not looking for near the ground, but instead, when you're out turkey hunting, you may have one about 30 feet up above you in the tree. And they are what I call the chameleons of the amphibian world. They change colors and so really blend in well to the background on which they're sitting. When the youngsters first emerge from the breeding pool, once they've gone through their tadpole stage, and they're these tiny little green, bright green tree frogs, you can find them often in the vegetation just a few inches up off the substrate around that breeding pond for a little while. But once they're adults, they are out there and they're up high rather than down below. If you have a light in your backyard by a big window and it attracts bugs, oftentimes I'd have people calling me. They have these frogs sticking to their window with those Garfield-like sort of suction cups on their toes, and those are gray tree frogs. By the way, Tom, what does that gray tree frog sound like?
You know, it's kind of a squeak, weak, 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 kind of like that. That's what it sounded like to me.
Well, Rebecca, what is it really?
Well, you know, every spring I have to keep reminding myself, red-bellied woodpecker or gray tree frog? Because it's really more of a little trill.
Oh, is it? Well, maybe that's not a tree frog I was hearing.
Yeah. So, but you can there are so many things out there in the springtime. As I was saying at the beginning of the program, so many changes. Distinguishing and remembering them from year to year, Tom, is a tough thing to do. And so you have to renew that, bring up that memory again. There we go.
Yeah, I found a tree frog.
That's right. Yeah. That's a good one.
Yeah. Yeah, that might be it.
Yeah, there you go.
Okay, Tom.
I was wondering if I could make a quick comment about gardener snakes, too. People I work with talk about killing them when they find them. And do you guys running any sort of education program for children about not killing snakes and that sort of thing?
Well, thank you for bringing that up. Actually, the last 10 years, I've been doing a lot of work, actually last dozen years, a lot of work with educational outreach regarding snakes. And part of the problem is that oftentimes our encounter with a snake is something we didn't plan on. We're taken by surprise. The snake is taken by surprise. And so neither of us is on our best behavior. And that's generally when it ends up not being a good scene for the snake. And yes, I talk to people a lot about not killing snakes, that, you know, really they're very useful. You want them around, particularly if you're a farmer and you've got something like bull snakes around. You know, there was some work done way back in about 1980 that demonstrated that a bull snake, you know, active on a farm for just a few months would save the agricultural producer somewhere in the line of $300 to $600 worth of grain. So if you think about that in 2010 dollars, you know, they're really pretty valuable. And they're gorgeous to look at.
What I try to tell them.
Well, thank you. Thank you for your efforts. We're doing the same exact thing. I should let you know, they're actually called garter snakes, just like men's garters that used to hold up their socks in that. Yeah. You often will see suspenders that almost look like garter snakes as well, black with the sort of green stripe going along its side. And that's what they were named after.
Okay. Thanks, Tom. Appreciate it. Let's go to Rose next. Rose is calling from Ankeny. Rose, you're on Talk of Iowa.
Yes, hello. It's my understanding that there is poaching of turtles going on in the Midwest, and poaching and for the meat sent to China. There was an article actually in the Des Moines Register in the last, year or so about this. And I wanted to hear what you had to say about it.
I don't know. I didn't see the article in the Register, but I do know that certainly turtles, particularly snapping turtles, are commonly legally trapped in Iowa for meat. There are many. I know of I won't say many, but I know of several places in Iowa that actually raise snapping turtles in ponds in their yards for meat, and so they're grown up to large size, fed regularly, just like other livestock, harvested, and the meat. What I think most of the meat is sold locally, but it may be that some is shipped out of the country. I don't know about other poaching efforts. Do you know of anything, Rebecca?
Rose, it was a good point you brought up. There is an increasing demand from Asia for turtles. Again, a lot of Asian turtles. There's a wonderful organization, if you're interested in turtles and how turtles are doing globally. It's called Turtle Survival Alliance, where you can learn more. But I know that the Iowa DNR is reexamining some of their regulations in terms of turtles because of the reported increase in turtle harvest.
Okay, Rose, appreciate the call.
Yeah. I want to get one thing in here before we run out of time, Dennison, yeah. And that is the there's a new organization called the Iowa Wildlife Center, which is attempting to rehabilitate, it's a statewide organization that's trying to rehabilitate critters. And this coming week, the Iowa Wildlife Center is having a big kickoff event. Going to have Doug Wood, who's a very well-known author and singer-songwriter, on the night of the 23rd, will be giving a concert in the Ames City Auditorium. And then out at Wildway, which is the site for this, will be the site for the statewide rehabilitators organization, will take place on Saturday the 24th. So if you want more information about that, you can go to www.iowawildlifecenter.org, and people can find out how to get tickets and that
right.
sort of thing.
So. Great. Our hour is up. Jim Pease, Professor Emeritus, and Rebecca Christoffel, Iowa State Extension Wildlife Specialist. Thanks so very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And we'll go out with some frogs. You know what this is, right?
Bullfrog.
Yes. Bullfrog. Our student assistant today was Christoph May. That's Talk of Iowa. I'm Dennis Reese.